At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help. So you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Amateur Traveler, episode 403. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about beautiful beaches, amazing trees, and isolation as we go to the island of Socotra off the coast of Yemen. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's episode, I do have three news stories for you. This is an odd story coming out of China. There is a theme park that is building a complete replica of the RMS Titanic. Not only can you go aboard the ship, but you can experience what it was like when it hit an iceberg. The theme park also boasts a man-made beach, Turkish baths, and what is called a 6D cinema. I don't know what it is, but it's apparently twice as good as 3D. Something that's not twice as good was a recent landing by some Southwest Airline pilots at the wrong airport. They only missed the airport they were looking for by 9 miles, touching down not at the Branson Airport, but at a nearby charter and personal aircraft airport. They had to put on the brakes rather hard because the runway was very short, and they brought the plane to a stop only 200 feet from a drop-off. Passengers then said 5 minutes later they were told they were at the wrong airport. And what I'd like to know is, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the conversation in the cockpit for those 5 minutes. There's a story out of the UK that a hotel manager was sacked for leaving negative comments on bad reviews on TripAdvisor. TripAdvisor recommends that you leave constructive comments. He left comments like this: "Honestly, what do you expect? You pay little, you get cheap. We're a budget hotel. Get real." The owner, after numerous complaints, finally let the manager go. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Earl from Wandering Earl, who's come to talk to us about Yemen and more specifically the island of Socotra. Earl, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Good to be here again.
And we were going to do this as a three-way interview also with Anil from Fox Nomad, who was on the show earlier talking about traveling to northern Iraq. But unfortunately, his internet connection wasn't up to the task today. But I actually understand you two traveled together to that. I didn't realize that when we had done that episode that you guys had traveled together to northern Iraq.
That was actually our first trip that we went to together. We tried to go to about one place per year that's a little bit more off the beaten path. We both sort of enjoy that kind of travel. So it just helps to sort of meet up and hit one of these destinations, Yemen being the one that we went to last year. So that was the first one over there in Iraqi Kurdistan.
And I found this interesting because you both are consummate travelers, and yet sometimes you even travel to some place that's not quite as comfortable, that stretches your safety zone here a bit. Mm-hmm. In fact, what was the way you put it before we started recording? It's good to have somebody along just in case.
Just in case you get kidnapped. Hopefully one person gets out and can inform your family. I'd like to think that that won't actually happen, but it is nice to have somebody else there just for some of these destinations, especially ones that don't receive so many travelers, where there's not as much information out there, I'd say, on the internet. So it is just a little more comforting when you go to a place like this with another traveler, especially another experienced traveler.
And we should say, when we've done a show on Yemen before, which is one of the reasons that I want to focus on Socotra, but that does bring up the issue of safety. Not most people don't choose their travel companions based on the possible kidnapping. So we are talking about a place that does have some safety issues right now.
Absolutely. There are definitely some safety issues there. I think this is definitely not a mainstream destination right now for travelers. It's a shame, though, because I will say, I think I was telling you before the show, that if it was safe, this would be one of the most popular countries that I can imagine. It would be so many travelers flocking here. Unfortunately, it's not safe. There is some tribal fighting going on. Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula is based in southern Yemen. They have a lot of internal problems. And as a result, the main threat for foreigners, there is a relatively high number of kidnappings compared to other countries. And that's sort of the main threat, that and getting caught up in sort of some random violence that does occur from time to time at the moment. So it's definitely not the safest of destinations.
So what did lead you to go to Yemen and to the island of Socotra in particular?
It all started with Socotra, where I wrote a post on my site once just asking my readers, what are some cool places that you've been? These are some cool places that I've heard of that I would like to go to. And one guy just wrote to me and said, you have to go here. That was all he said. He just said, you have to go here, with a link to Socotra Island. That was maybe a year and a half before I actually went. And ever since then, I need to get there. But of course, I always saw it's Yemen. And I was like, oh, that's crazy. I'm not going to Yemen.
Says the guy who went to Iraq, but...
Yeah, right. Well,
as a tourist.
That turned out to be much, much... If you do a little more research, that turns out to be a heck of a lot safer. It's quite safe up there in Iraq, Kurdistan. But I did do some more research and slowly said, it's not the most normal destination, but it is possible. And there are spots that you can go that it's actually... The government, there's a lot of checkpoints on the mainland, and you can only go certain areas. The government won't let foreigners through into areas that they deem more dangerous. So there are some precautions there, that are some measures in place to reduce the risk for foreigners, let's say. It's still not I wouldn't say a complete safe destination, but it does reduce the risk. And yeah, so I thought, well, this actually is possible, and if I'm going there, I'm definitely going to Socotra. And yeah, I just got it in my head, and me and Anil both had time to do it, and we made it happen.
Okay. So, and I'm assuming since you pitched the show to me that you think other people should go with the cautions that we've already put in place surrounding it. So what did you do? What kind of itinerary would you recommend?
Yeah. And I will say first, so basically for the mainland has a little few more issues. Socotra, nothing. There's no reason why anyone can't go to Socotra. Anybody. There's nothing going on in Socotra. It's not dangerous. There's no threat of anything, nothing whatsoever. You can actually now, starting this year in a couple of months, you'll be able to fly there directly from United Arab Emirates and from Milan in Italy. Okay. So you'll be able to skip the mainland altogether, and you won't even need an official Yemen visa. You can get a Socotra permit that will allow you just to go to the island. So that's a big benefit there, and that's great. So that Socotra is completely safe. The mainland is the place that has some issues. So when we went, we basically did go, flew into Sana'a, into the capital and the mainland, hung out there for a couple of days in the old city, absolutely beautiful. And then we went on a sort of a journey around the mainland I can list some of the names of the towns that are called Shibam and Kalkaban and Mahwi, Al-Hajara, and all these little towns and villages that are basically perched right up in the mountains. That's the thing that struck me the most of the mainland, because of its tribal history, that all the towns and villages, the majority, are built on the tops of mountains. I mean, and it's just not just on a flat plateau on the top of the mountain, it's built onto the cliffs and into the most improbable of locations. And you have these buildings that are hundreds of years old, up 700 years old, made of mud, brick, and stone, that are still standing. They say that they're the original skyscrapers in the world, basically. And it's just something that you can't see anywhere else. So we did spend about 6 days going around that area with a driver and a guide. And then we went back to Sana'a, and then we flew to Socotra Island, where we spent 4 days in Socotra before heading out. So that was the overall itinerary on Socotra. It's actually a much larger island than people would think. It's quite large. So we actually, even in the time we were there, only got to see maybe about 30% of it. It's quite an enormous place, but a very unique destination, and a place that I absolutely think more people should definitely go. Ignore the fact that it's attached to Yemen, and should definitely just make their way there.
Okay, and let's go back and do that in more detail, but let's do it in the opposite order. Let's start with the island, since that's really what we want to focus on. Sure. So you mentioned that it's an interesting destination, but I don't know what I'm going to see there.
Yeah, I have no idea. And the thing is, it's one of these places, you fly in, which there's not even, at the moment, I don't even think there's daily flights, but you fly in, you can't even call it an airport. You walk out of the plane right into the building. And the first creature that I saw on the island were goats inside the airport. So there was a herd of goats just walking around on their own inside the airport. And then that was pretty much the introduction. It's completely open. There's no checks. There's no nothing. Nothing's going on. You go outside, and basically, so this island is huge. If you were to drive around the entire island, it would take about eight hours or so. What we basically saw, and this is pretty incredible for one location, it has some of the largest sand dunes in the world, which are these white sand dunes that start up to 1,000 meters high and that come all the way down an entire mountain, straight down onto the coast, into the water, into the obviously beautiful turquoise Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean. Absolutely stunning. You have canyons, you have caves. You have, I guess you could describe them as lagoons. You have these incredible plateaus, again, in the most improbable places. You have trees that you pretty much can't see anywhere else. There's incredible dragon's blood trees, which are, I mean, it really looks like you've stepped into Alice in Wonderland kind of place. When you hear, I've heard a lot of people describe Sococha that have been as the Galapagos on steroids. And I would pretty much, okay, I've never been to the Galapagos, but I can't imagine anywhere more surreal than this island. And everywhere you go, it's a completely different. You have a mountain, then you're down on these sand dunes, then you're in this lagoon area, then you're at this plateau, then you're inside of a canyon. I mean, there's a whole area of all these magnificent caves. I mean, it's just nonstop all everywhere, completely different views and landscapes, and pretty spectacular place.
Okay, and I'm going to slow you down yet again. We're going to go into a little more detail with a few more place names and how to get there. So the sand dunes, let's start with that.
Sure. So first, just to let you know, you actually can't get anywhere on your own.
Okay.
This sounds like a lot, but there's 50,000 people on the island. It's very poor. The infrastructure is – actually, money isn't even really used there. People just kind of trade goats, fish, stuff like that. So there's actually no transportation.
So the goats you saw in the airport were being traded for airplane tickets, is what
most likely. Yeah, probably. I think they were for the pilot. So there's actually no like public transportation. When locals want to get somewhere, they literally just walk out to the road and hope that one of the handful of people with a car or one of the trucks that's on the island picks them. Well, they always pick them up. And so it's just a complete hitchhiking thing. So you do need to actually hire a driver if you want to get to most of the island, because 50,000 people on an island this big is not a lot of people. So for the most part, you're in places in the absolute middle of nowhere. So you do need a driver to get around. But to get up to the sand dunes, it's called a place called Delicia.
And you mentioned an island this big. We haven't really put some dimensions on it. So we're talking about, and I'm looking it up here, 132 kilometers or 82 miles long and about 50 kilometers wide or 31 miles. So decent size. Okay.
Decent. And the thing to remember too is most of the interior is mountainous. So you're really on these small windy roads that are going in. So it makes it even seem more remote and more far away from places where it might only be 10 miles away from the place, but it's going to take you 2 hours because you're going through these just half the time. Actually, there were no roads. You're just literally driving on the off-roading basically just to get even to villages and stuff like that. So it's not even every place isn't even really necessarily connected by an actual road.
And how did you find a driver?
I actually was put in touch with a company called Eternal Yemen, basically a company that somebody else had recommended. And okay. I got in touch with them and they sort of helped us put it together. And it was great. I mean, they're very friendly on this island. They love having foreigners. I think the last I saw was that they were expecting approximately in the last few years, about 1,000 foreigners per year.
Oh, wow. That's small.
Yep. It's not so much. So they're pretty happy when foreigners come. They're very nice people. They're very open.
And three a day.
That would be about right. And in the time that we were there, we only saw one. Yeah, I met one French woman and a Syrian guy who was traveling. That was it. So there was technically two other travelers that we met during our entire time there.
And is your driver then also acting as interpreter?
So we had a driver and then we had a guide. The drivers don't, not many people have driving license on the island. So the driver is sort of a specialty. And then the guide is, we had one of the, I think they told us there's about six guides on the island that pretty much speak enough English that they could be a guide.
And if I can ask, are we talking, is it fairly expensive or is it fairly inexpensive to get a driver and a guide? I mean, that doesn't sound like your normal style of travel here.
No, it doesn't. It's actually tough because basically there's also, which we can talk about, accommodation is not really anything you can book on your own either. There are no hotels or places you can go online and book stuff. Uh-huh. You need somebody to put it all together. There's sort of these echo lodges, which are basically some guy took some wood out of somewhere and built stone and wood, the most basic huts you've ever seen, but normally right on the white sand beach. They have a shared bathroom behind it for like four huts, and it includes your dinner. And that's pretty much it. So the whole package, I think, came out to about $80 per day for two people.
Well, that's not bad. And that's not, bad. Not counting the driver and the guide.
No, that was with the driver and the guide.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay, wow.
I think it balances out. I would say $60 of that would be for the driver and guide per day, and not even 20 would be for the accommodation. The accommodation is pretty basic.
Wow, okay.
I mean, it was like a stone bed with like a very thin mattress kind of thing. Amazing.
Stone bed, okay.
No matter even what your travel style, I don't think you would mind when you see the location where you're sleeping.
Right, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, so.
And I'm picturing beaches that are not crowded with people either, as you talk about these turquoise waters here of the Arabian Sea.
I went to about maybe 4 or 5 beaches on this trip and never saw a single other person on any of them. literally. It was the most amazing beach I've ever seen in my life is this place that called Dalisha, which is where the sand dunes are coming right down the mountain. So you look behind you and it's just these massive sand dunes that stretch for 3 kilometers, maybe, I would have to say, of just pure white sand coming down the mountainside right into the turquoise water. It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. And there was not one person around. Hmm. So, yeah, really spectacular. And that's pretty much everything, even if it's not the beaches, if it's the caves or the canyon, there's nobody. Okay. Occasionally, I remember 2 kids came running up to us, local kids, and it was a big deal.
And you mentioned the canyon, so let's go there next. What canyon are we talking about?
Yep, so basically you go up to an area called the Dixon Plateau, which is the big plateau in the center. And it's just this massive canyon, and there's opportunities in there for obviously hiking. A few adventurous groups, I think they were telling me French groups, go there to do some rock climbing. There are caves up in the middle of the cliffs that people have explored, but slowly, obviously, with only 1,000 foreigners coming per year. It's just a massive canyon, basically in the exact center of the island. And even more impressive than the canyon, I would say, is even the ride to get up there. That's probably one of the most remote parts of the island. And you're on really where you really are driving off-road through these huge forests of dragon's blood trees that I mentioned, which are these big mushroom-shaped trees that are huge. And there are just thousands of them everywhere. And you're on this really weird, almost, okay, I've never been to Mars, but it looks like the photos. I mean, it's like these really strange rocks and this really strange earth. And you have these surreal trees sticking out of it everywhere you look. And you're basically driving in and out of these trees, and then suddenly you stop at this small village, and there you are looking at this incredible canyon ahead of you. So,
and you mentioned the dragon's blood trees, and you've said this before. I'm going to get you to try and describe these, because I've got a picture in front of me, but they're a little odd.
They're quite odd. They're basically, so I would say the majority of them are about 10 feet tall, maybe, and sort of looks like a mushroom for the most part. It has a trunk that sticks up sort of a little bit. Most of them would then break into 2 trunks, and they would go up a couple more feet, and then you have this weird web system of branches almost parallel to the ground. So there's like dozens of branches just stretching out like little arms, like parallel to the ground. And on the top of them all is the mushroom part is these sort of this green, almost like a fern type of plant on the top of it. So it basically looks like this bizarre mushroom where you can see the underground of the underneath part, which looks like sort of the underneath of a mushroom with its sort of like black little web there. And I mean, standing in front of one of them is bizarre, and then to see a whole quote-unquote forest of them on a sort of desert-like landscape is just really fascinating. But yeah, I mean, that's the best thing to describe is that it's these big, sort of big mushroom trees about 10 feet tall, and I would say they stretch, I mean, the actual mushroom part, they're at least maybe 10 to even 15 feet wide, I would say, at some of the bigger ones.
Okay, excellent. The other thing in terms of trees that I think of when I think of Socotra is frankincense.
Yes.
Because this is the source, I mean, when we hear in the Bible about gold, frankincense, and myrrh, the frankincense probably came from here. I mean, this is how long this island has been a part of trade routes.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting, because I was going to say later, pretty much the only thing as a foreigner that you can buy, the kids that are running around with it, trying to sell. I mean, that's it. You do see the trees everywhere. And there's, I'm trying to remember the name because so many places, but if I remember correctly, it's Sok, which is S-O-Q, where there's this quote-unquote forest where you see both of them mixed together, and you see that has the most intense, I would say, concentration of both dragon's blood. It has the frankincense. It's just completely scattered all over the place. Yeah, that was Sok, actually, S-O-Q.
Well, that makes sense because I was reading that the name of the island literally means market of the dripping frankincense, because frankincense being the resin that comes out the side of the tree. So, interesting.
Yep.
And I actually don't even remember what you do with it these days. It's used in perfume and incense, I guess. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was used. I know the kids were selling it. They would sell it to actually the sap, or they would sell it in like these crystallized cubes. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much, it was literally just a plastic bag of it.
What was your biggest surprise in Socotra? I mean, you're in this unusual destination, off the grid.
First, the biggest surprise is that nobody knows about it. That's one major surprise for what is on that island. I will say about 90, if you asked 100 people, probably 90 people have never heard of it.
I think that's probably optimistic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's one of the biggest things, given what is there. I mean, I have never seen another place that offers so much that nobody knows about. I mean, I'm sure there's other places out there that I don't know about as well, but it's pretty incredible. I will say the other thing is the isolation, because, okay, it's a little bit isolated. It's about, I think, 300 kilometers off the coast of Yemen, maybe 200-something off the coast of Somalia. It's not in the middle of the South Pacific, but the culture on there is extremely isolated. So there's very little connection between the island, the people there, and basically the outside world. So it really was fascinating to sit down with them. The fact that they barely use money there, they have very little money, and there's no ferries or anything to go anywhere, and there's no reason for them to go anywhere. So they would have to fly to leave the island, which nobody can afford. They actually speak Sokotri. They speak their own language. There's actually no real connection to Yemen for the most part, culturally. Our guide actually was telling us about the one time that he went to the mainland because he was translating for a French NGO, and he was at the age of 28, which was only a year before I was there with him. And he told us, I mean, he had never been, he rode an elevator up and down for 15 minutes because he couldn't figure out what it was.
Like, oh my gosh.
NGO, okay. The NGO said, here, just go here. Your room's on the fifth floor. So he didn't want to feel silly. So he went in there and he rode up and down, had no idea. And was just following people around. He had no idea what that thing was. He didn't know if he was going up, down, left, right. So it really, which is a little bit hard to imagine, a place that still really is that disconnect. They only have one computer on the island that has internet. And according to our guide, it takes 15 minutes to send an email. So obviously that's no big deal. Just the point being, that's how isolated it is. And it's a whole community of 50,000 people that's by far the most isolated place I've been to. I've been to some pretty isolated places in the middle of the South Pacific. But even there, even places where people don't even really wear clothes, they still had a much better idea of what was on the outside world than this island.
Now, stop me if I'm wrong. I'm going to guess that even with as isolated as that, they still have cell phones.
Not many at all.
Not many
at all. Yep. It's a pretty much, if you are going to go meet your friend, you just go to the street, hitchhike, and go to his village. yeah, literally, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they were basically telling us that even though it's 50,000 people, everybody knows literally everybody. And you know what they do and where they're going to be at any time.
And what kind of resources did you use for planning your trip?
I tried to just go online, just tried to find whatever I could just to get an idea, because I knew that it was, when I started to learn that it was an extremely large island in terms of how much you could actually access in a reasonable amount of time, that we sort of started to look and try to figure out what places seemed a little bit more interesting to us. And then we did contact the company that I mentioned before, Eternal Yemen, that helped us get the driver and the guy. But the thing is, it's so laid back that we just showed up and we told them the places that we thought were interesting. Of course, that's where outsiders with no clue. So then they told us the reality of what made more sense or what they thought would be interesting. And it's pretty much open. I mean, you have the driver and guide. There's no set time or anything. So you can pretty much go wherever. And if you're somewhere and you're like, this isn't so interesting, they'll take you wherever. So it's kind of the place you really wouldn't plan like a specific route before you go. There's actually just one road that goes around the island. So you just kind of, you're always just going back and forth on that road and then turning off onto like dirt roads or side roads to get places. So you don't really need to have a specific itinerary, but some places are more accessible than others. So I'd say it depends on how much time you have to spend there. That would sort of dictate how much you could actually see.
What's one thing you wish you had known before you went?
I wish I had known that actually, even though I did know that it was not everything was as accessible as would be ideal, I wish I had really known how inaccessible some parts would have been, because had I known, I would have doubled the time I would have stayed. I thought that we assumed that 4 or 5 days would be plenty, but you could easily spend 2 weeks there to really get a feel for the island. So I would say I would have done that, gone at a much slower pace to really enjoy some of these, because some of these places are places that the landscape or something is something that just doesn't exist anywhere else. And it would have been nice if some of these spectacular places, one place called Kalansia, which is on the like the northwest side of the island, which is, I'm actually going to write a post in a couple of weeks where my favorite spots in the world, and that's 100% one of them that I've ever seen. And it would have been nice to, say, spend a couple nights there as opposed to the few hours that we were able to spend there, just given our time constraints. So.
And what made it one of your favorite spots in the world?
You drive up this hill and you have no idea what's coming, and then you suddenly hit the top and you stop and you're looking down sort of a dirtish road that goes straight down to the ocean, again in this huge, almost like semicircle white sand dune with a lagoon down in the bottom. So then there's like this sandbar that's stretching out way out, maybe half a kilometer out, that does a complete circle. It's just incredible water. It's surrounded by this white sand. I don't know, you just have to see it. I mean, with the white sand, the mountains, and the water all mixed together in this one sort of isolated, almost not a valley, but it's completely kind of closed off in a semicircle. So you can't even see civilization behind you at all. You're just literally in this little corner of the world. And there's like two open air huts. If you can spend the night there, it's literally just a grass roof. Like there's no walls, nothing. It's actually just four posts with a very, like a grass roof over your head and some like really thin, very, very, very thin, like centimeter thin mats on the ground. And you're more than welcome to spend the night there if you want for free. And it's just, I wish we had known and would have definitely spent a couple nights in that spot.
It strikes me as funny just because we sometimes cover a range of destinations on Amateur Traveler. And I was just in Vegas and put up in the Tropicana in a suite with two bedrooms and three LCDs and everything was electronic. You could control the drapes and gorgeous, gorgeous hotel room. And it isn't necessarily that is better than a grass hut on a beautiful beach, but it's just different. I mean, there is a range of vacation opportunities, and we are off towards one end here.
Absolutely. And they match the destinations.
Exactly.
Las Vegas would be pretty miserable in a hut, and I would say that Sococha would be pretty bizarre if there was a suite to be had. It would be pretty odd. It wouldn't maybe even match that. There is actually, apparently there is one small hotel in the capital village, which is just a dirt road village. I think it was like, they told me maybe 1,000 people. And there is a hotel someone started there where the rooms are $100 a night. Okay. I mean, he has like 7 or 8 rooms, but apparently that's the least used accommodation on the island. So,
Now, one of the questions I normally ask is, when did you feel closest to home? When was it most familiar? And when did you feel furthest from home? You know, when was it most unfamiliar? Was any part of this real familiar? It sounds...
I was just going to say, there really was nothing familiar. I mean, I've traveled quite a lot. Even the airport experience was something that I have, I mean, in all my travels.
The goats is a giveaway, yeah.
I mean, the goats, then you see the cargo coming off the plane, and it was amazing. I mean, it was just like, I mean, it was just boxes of mangoes. There was a box of bricks. You're just seeing the most random stuff because there's nothing on the island. I mean, everything, just your normal... Absolutely anything you need is coming in on this plane. And so from the start, I was just like, this is bizarre. And it was just straight, actually, there's one tourist police on the island. So that, at first I was like, okay, we saw him in the beginning. I was like, that's interesting. Like he's actually, it's pretty organized. But that was it. That's where it ended right there. Like the one tourist police, I mean, it was pretty funny. Actually, we couldn't even communicate with him. And he just welcomed us for about 20 minutes. Pretty much just welcome to Sococha. That was it. And after that, as soon as we left outside the airport parking lot, I was just, the landscape is, again, it's something that you just can't see anywhere else, and immediately you just feel like you're in another planet. And after that, there was really nothing. From the food to the people to the culture to the landscapes to the accommodation, there was basically no connection and there's no familiarity whatsoever.
And you say the food, we haven't talked about food. What was that like?
It's a lot of fish.
I would hope.
It's pretty much fish for lunch, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and some rice, and the occasional vegetable. Yeah, it's pretty basic, but the fish is great. Yeah, you basically get a piece of fish and a plate of rice is the standard for most meals. But it was great. I mean, you have the guy who runs the four little huts, him and his family, they're cooking for you, and they come and sit with you, and they try their best. Every place we stay, they want to talk to you, they want to interact with you. They absolutely love having people there. More than most places that I've ever been there, they're so excited that people are coming there. Because they know, and they always will say, yes, we're part of Yemen, but we're not. It's not Yemen. Like, you can come here. There's no problems. Everybody's open. There's no, like, real police. There's no jail. There's no crime. There's nothing happens there. Because nobody can leave. It's 50,000 people on one island. You can't escape anywhere. So nothing ever happens. And it really is extremely safe. And it is a shame, actually, obviously it's part of Yemen, but it is a shame that it automatically gets grouped in with the stuff happening 300 kilometers away on the mainland. But hopefully the direct flights from other countries will open it up a little bit.
Excellent. I want to talk a little bit about your experience on the mainland. Is there anything else we should cover on Sokotra before we do that?
If you are interested in getting over there, spend a week there. Really make the most of it. And because it is, almost everybody that I know that has gone wishes they stayed longer. There's an area called Neat way out in the west corner. There's places in the south, all these caves and beaches on the south that I wish that we had time to get to. But again, yeah, I would say definitely spend a week, go slow, camp out there, and just really, really enjoy the experience. If you're going to go all the way to Sokotra Island in the middle of nowhere, definitely make the most of it.
Excellent. Impressions about the mainland. You mentioned it being one of the most interesting, and you talked about the buildings that were 700 years old and were the original skyscrapers. I would have to say that when I see pictures of Yemen, they don't look like pictures of any place else.
Yeah, I would say a part of it has to do with that architectural style, because even the old city of Sana'a, jokingly they call it the original Manhattan, it is literally hundreds of buildings that are up to 10, 12 stories high that are built out of this material. And it's a very consistent architectural style where they sort of then put some paint on the outside and some intricate designs oftentimes. And I haven't seen anywhere else that uses this style. So to see these towns, say, in the old city, right in the middle of the capital, and then to go into the mountains and see the similar, these crazy structures implanted right in the side of the cliff, and then to go to the top of the mountain to see them hanging on to these tiny little summits of a mountain, these rocky summits, it really just makes for a landscape, the sights that totally surreal. And really, I can't even really remember any town that was on flat ground down below, apart from the capital. So it really, you're always looking up and seeing these villages everywhere up above you. Everything's up above you. And coupled with the valleys, the mountains, I mean, everything that you just see there, it really is a spectacular place to go, at least. And that was only a very small part of it.
Right. And of course, usually when you build the cities like that, it's not built for convenience, but for defense. Yeah. So Yemen hasn't always been it's had problems for many years in terms of just being tribal and things like that.
Yeah.
We did a show I mentioned on Yemen before, a fascinating show, and obviously had some concerns about doing a show about some place that has definitely safety issues. Mm-hmm. You were just there. I don't know if there's anything that we should mention that is new or different. I mean, Al-Qaeda being there is relatively new, being active in some areas of the country.
I mean, for safety, unfortunately, in the last, say, 6 months, the situation has deteriorated a little bit where sort of there have been a few more incidents close to the capital or in the capital, for example. Almost nothing has ever happened in the old city of Sana'a. So before that, it was always, you could always get from the airport straight into the old city, which is a big walled area of the capital. Generally, it's huge, so you would never have to even leave there. You could experience this, which is the heart of Sana'a anyway. Unfortunately, there has been a couple of things just on the outskirts at like the main gate to the old city. So things are starting to happen a little more closer. Things are not generally geared aimed at foreigners at all. It's right. Just that there is more incidents happening, so obviously you need to be a little more careful. In the countryside, however, for where you can go, you do need permits. You need a ton of permits. We went through dozens and dozens of checkpoints, and without a permit, you're not going to get through as a foreigner. And certain areas, they won't let you in because they'll say, well, the government has now deemed this area unsafe, so foreigners are not allowed to go. So you have to turn, go another road, go to a different region.
And even when you were there, it was on the State Department watch list already of this is
not a safe. Yeah, it was definitely on the state. Every place, it was definitely on the State Department watch list and for almost any country's watch list. I think the idea is to be obviously cautious for for a normal traveler, which makes sense. But again, it very rarely examines what the actual situation is, which is again where, yes, there are some areas that are extremely dangerous. There's no way you could even get there. No way. You can't get on a bus to go there. Nobody will sell you a bus ticket. A checkpoint will never let you through. Not a chance. So, I mean, the areas that we were able to go were deemed safe. And to be perfectly honest, there was not even 1 minute of us feeling any threat whatsoever from any villagers. Everyone we met was overly warm, hospitable, and super friendly to us, inviting us for meals and into their homes, everything, nonstop. There wasn't one single negative, whether they found out from the U.S. or anything like that, nothing. No, there was nothing. I imagine that would be different in certain areas where you're not allowed to go, but then again, you're not allowed to go for a reason. And if you stick to that, which you pretty much have no choice, then it can be done in a safer way.
Question for you. So, and I'm going to make this a two-part question. One for Socotra and the other for the rest of Yemen. You're standing in the most beautiful spot you saw, and you're going to take a picture of what? Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
On the mainland, by far, that's a place called Bokor, which is a road, a sort of a main road cutting through eastern Yemen. And I don't know how the driver knows, but obviously they know. They just turn off suddenly and start driving over the rocks for about 15 minutes, and suddenly they come to the cliff. You're actually at the top of a cliff with the rocks are actually jutting out over the valley below, which is about 1,500 meters below. Big drop down into this huge lush green valley where there's a couple of scattered villages like stuck into the cliff and down in the valley. And you're just basically standing on this rock that is completely jutting out over this valley, hanging over the edge of this massive valley. It was totally surreal again. Just, of course, you would never see it unless your driver drives off-road and knows how to get there. That was by far the most magical spot that I saw on the mainland. And for Socotra, I mentioned Kalansia before, so that I won't mention that again. There's the other place. Yeah, I'll go back to that Dalisha place, which is, again, that stretch of 3 kilometers white sand beach where perfect water, perfect sand. You have the mountains again behind you, and you have a stretch of what I think, what I've seen in all my travels, the most beautiful beach I've ever seen. All to yourself, 100% all to yourself, just right there in the Indian Ocean. I could have built my own hut and stayed there for a week easily.
Okay.
Next time.
Again, two-part question.
Sure.
Socotra and the mainland, the sense, I mean, of the five senses that you will most remember from both places, is it a sight? Is it a smell? Is it a taste?
I would say for both places, it would be a sight, simply because these areas, again, I would say the mainland is visited by so many people if it was safe, just because there are things that you will never see anywhere else, and the same can be said for Socotra. So your eyes are open wide the entire time, day, night, doesn't matter. You're just totally blown away by what you're seeing wherever you go.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Yemen or only on Socotra?
In Yemen, I would say that the constant amount of people trying to get you to shoot their guns.
What?
It's like everywhere you go, for a fee, of course.
Of course.
But it's like everywhere you go, people are trying to stick their guns, because people do walk around with guns. They're not necessarily to use against people. It's generally more of celebrations. There's gunshots going off all the time. It's one of those cultures where weddings, day and night, there's gunshots going off for celebrations. But everywhere you go, for some reason, that even though there's almost no tourists there, they have this idea that foreigners would love to shoot their guns for an astronomical fee, by the way, about $3 a bullet, which I don't shoot many guns, but it sounds pretty astronomical for Yemen. And it would happen all the time. Just complete strangers would come up and like hand you the guns and be like trying to mimic shooting the gun. And I'll take you to the – our guide would translate, oh, they'll take you to over here. You can shoot to the mountain or something. I mean, it just happened all the time where – and our guide could not believe that we did not want to shoot a gun. Like, I'm not a big gun guy, so I didn't want to shoot one. And the guide just could not believe that we didn't want to shoot guns. They like literally were blown away, were just confused.
Okay, that's a unique one, and I'm glad I asked the question. Now, the other thing that I recall is in Yemen, one of the prized souvenirs from the mainland is the daggers as well. Is that still the case?
Yes, absolutely. The jalebi, that's everywhere. That's an interesting thing, because you go to some countries and you see traditional dress and it's usually used for celebrations or things like that these days. But no, it's 100% used. I'd say about 90% of the males still wear the traditional clothes with the dagger in their belt. It is a ceremonial dagger, so it's not a fighting dagger. But yeah, everybody has it, and there are places that you can buy, and they're pretty amazing what you can get. Obviously they vary in all prices and things like that, but you can go to some of the shops and watch them actually hand make the cases that they come in, and it's a pretty big symbol there. So everybody wants to have the nicest one possible, and you see kids as soon as they can walk, boys, they have the little dagger in their clothes. Huh. So yeah, really interesting. And I first see that and you think immediately it's a fighting thing, of course. But when you actually see the dagger and it's completely curved around, it would be the worst fighting tool ever. So then you learn, of course, then you talk to people and you learn it's ceremonial. I mean, they use it, they dance all the time. They're using it for dancing and for, things like that. So
excellent. Finish this sentence. You really know you're in Yemen, or you really know you're in Socotra when what?
You really know you're in Yemen when you don't want to go to sleep because you know that there's something else unbelievable out there to see. I mean, it really is that kind of a place. You really know you're in Socotra when you consider moving there, despite the fact that have the complete lack of infrastructure, internet, all that stuff in the modern world, and you still are debating with yourself whether you should take over for the only English teacher that's on the island. There is one Australian guy.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize, and let's focus on Socotra in three words, what three words would you use?
Isolated, stunning, and memorable. Yeah.
Excellent. Earl, where can people read more about your travels?
They can head over to wanderingearl.com, put all kinds of things about the places I visit and the lifestyle of long-term travel. And it's all up over there.
Excellent. Where are you going next?
Well, I am looking at potentially going to Libya in February, and then I'll be heading back to India in March.
Excellent.
So that's as far as I've gotten.
And we should say again that you traveled on this trip with Anil of Fox Nomad. I'm sorry that he wasn't able to be with us on this particular episode, but we'll get him back on the show when he has better internet sometime.
Absolutely. Bad internet. It's part of the traveling world. You never know what kind of internet you get.
So. Could have been worse. He could have been on Socotra.
Yeah.
Earl, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
No, I appreciate you having me. Thanks. Thank you.
In news of the community, I heard last week a feedback from Jeffrey about the episode we did on traveling to Vieques. He said, I'm an emergency physician from northern New England, not unfamiliar with travel in the Caribbean, and I encountered a problem in Vieques that Ira didn't discuss. The locals had warned me not to eat a fish larger than my plate, but in restaurants, you really have no control over this. Eating out in Vieques, I had the snapper. I even complimented the chef on how good it was. Fortunately, my wife and son chose other dishes. That night, I had severe vomiting and diarrhea. I don't think I was dehydrated as my pulse was slow. The GI symptoms abated by the morning, but I thought it was odd. When I walked across the floor, my feet were burning. Likewise, when I washed my hands, they would burn. On discussing this with the proprietor of our apartment, he told me I had ciguatera poisoning, something that I had not seen where I work for some reason. I spoke to one of the consultants at our local tertiary care facility who told me that the neurotoxin effects would last for weeks to months and that I should avoid reef fish as the next exposure would be worse since the toxin is fat soluble and stays in your adipose tissue. I didn't realize that I would get a first-hand medical experience in Vieques and just want to pass this on to you and your listeners as it is a real concern in the islands. The toxin can affect your gait and your heart if repeatedly ingested. Jeff, thanks so much for that, and we'll pass that along. I also heard recently from Sarah, who said, I just wanted to tell you how much I love your podcast. I drive back and forth from Toronto to Windsor quite frequently, and I have really enjoyed listening to both recent and older episodes throughout my drive. I especially liked the 2007 episode on Kingston, Ontario, having lived there for a few years for school. I downloaded the episode expecting that it would be a bit out of date, but it really held up. Your guest covered absolutely everything I would recommend for visitors to the city. Anyway, thanks for all your hard work on this podcast. You've literally provided me with hours and hours of entertainment, as well as a lot of inspiration for my future travels. Best, Sarah. Thanks so much, Sarah. It's always good to know that people are enjoying the show, and better yet, let me know when you've gone to some of the places you've listened to on Amateur Traveler. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com or join the Facebook community. You can also follow me on Twitter @ChrisToX. And as always, thanks so much for listening.